Pacifica Radio. This is Democracy Now! As Kurdish rebel leader Abdullah Öcalan is deported to Turkey, thousands of Kurds protest around the world, dozens setting themselves on fire. We'll look at American Airlines and the pilot's sick out while they're returning to work. What is the labor relations picture of the airline? And a Department of Justice study finds that Native Americans are twice as likely to be victims of violent crimes. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Turkey has captured the fugitive Kurdish rebel leader Abdullah Öcalan in Kenya overnight and brought him to Turkey. In Turkey, he is accused of being a terrorist by the government and could face the death penalty. His capture has ignited a wave of protests by Kurds across the country and Europe, directed largely against Greece, which, in circumstances not clearly explained, allowed Öcalan to pass through the hands of the Kenyan authorities to those of Turkey. Öcalan's supporters took the Greek ambassador's family hostage in the Netherlands. At Greek embassies in Athens and London, Kurdish demonstrators threatened mass suicide. As many as 60 Kurds set themselves on fire. Greek embassies and consulates were occupied in at least a dozen European cities, as were the Kenyan embassy in Vienna and the United Nations European headquarters in Geneva. Turkey still has capital punishment on its statutes books, the reason it failed last year to extradite him from Italy. Öcalan had been bounced from country to country for months with Turkey, which wants to prosecute him as a terrorist, applying heavy diplomatic pressure everywhere he sought refuge. Öcalan's German lawyer said that he had been tricked into agreeing to be handed over by the Greek embassy in Nairobi to the Kenyan authorities. Öcalan's Kurdistan Workers' Party, or PKK, called it a very dangerous and ambiguous development. We'll have more on Öcalan later in the show. Meanwhile, the city-by-city tally of protests, around 150 Kurds stormed the Greek ambassador's residence at The Hague, taking hostage the ambassador's wife and family. In London, about 100 Kurdish demonstrators occupied the Greek embassy in London. In Brussels, some 50 Kurdish protesters occupied the Greek embassy there. In Vienna, activists stormed the Greek and Kenyan embassies. In Marseille, several dozen demonstrators occupied the Greek consulate. In Moscow, about 40 Kurdish protesters forced their way into the Greek embassy. And it goes on from there around Europe. This news from Guinea-Conakry. Wailing relatives threw themselves onto the airport tarmac, and cabinet ministers stood at attention yesterday when the body of a man gunned down by New York City police officers 2 weeks ago was returned to his home country. Some 350 Guineans, including the country's entire cabinet and dozens of other top officials, were waiting at the airport when the body of Amadou Diallo, whose death set off an uproar over alleged police brutality in New York, was brought off an Air France flight from Paris. Hundreds more people watched from the roadside as the motorcade snaked through the streets of this ramshackle seaside city, taking Diallo's coffin to a hospital morgue. Four white police officers fired 41 bullets at the 22-year-old street merchant, an unarmed man, as he stood in the vestibule of his Bronx apartment building. He was hit 19 times. The death of Diallo has become a rallying cry in the West African nation of Guinea. This news from Belfast. Gerry Adams, head of the IRA's political arm, prepared today for urgent talks in London with British Prime Minister Tony Blair as the Northern Irish peace process reached a crucial stage. A spokesman for his Sinn Féin party said Adams would urge Blair to trigger the creation of a shadow ruling executive for the British province, which seats for with seats for Sinn Féin and transfer home rule powers from London to Belfast following a key vote today in the fledgling Northern Ireland Assembly. Britain wants to transfer powers to a 10-member Protestant-Catholic power-sharing executive on March 10th in accordance with last April's Good Friday peace agreement. But Protestant unionists say they'll refuse to sit alongside Sinn Féin if the Irish Republican Army does not hand over its arms. And this news from Indonesia, a shooting at an independence rally in the Indonesian province of Aceh left at least 11 people dead and 24 others missing. The military had earlier said 7 civilians were killed February 3rd in the East Aceh town of Idikut. Villagers said that those killed were shot by security forces. And finally, a Nigerian ex-dictator won the presidential nomination of the leading People's Democratic Party. Olusegun Obasanjo's selection came as two rival parties named a former finance minister as their joint candidate. And that's some of the news. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Most pilots with American Airlines have returned to work after a 10-day massive sick-out to protest a two-tiered pay scale imposed by the airline after it bought Reno Air, a smaller airline. After canceling about 12% of its flights yesterday, American announced it expected to fly nearly all of its scheduled flights today. The pilots returned to work after a federal judge, Joe Kendall, ordered the pilots' union, the Texas-based Allied Pilots Association, to end the sick out and then fine the union when the pilots disregarded the order. Kendall's order of contempt against the union said in part, "Unfortunately, the radical element that appears to be in control of the Allied Pilots Association seems determined to fly American Airlines into the side of the mountain, taking themselves, the company, their co-workers, and their customers with them," unquote. He also called the pilots' demands a minor dispute and added that the pilots making the demands all make in excess of 6 figures. Well, the sick out has made headlines every day as stranded passengers over the holiday weekend gave furious interviews to the media. An economist talked about losses for the airline mounting to over $100 million. What really lies behind the labor dispute? We're joined by a few people right now. We're going to start with Julius Gettman, professor of labor law at the University of Texas and visiting professor at Georgetown University. He's author of the book, The Betrayal of Local 14, and that's about an 87 strike against the International Paper Company. But Professor Julius Gettman, can you lay out for us what you understand to be the issue here at American Airlines? Clearly, the judge extremely unsympathetic to the union.
Well, that's certainly true. It's very difficult to know exactly what's involved. There is a protest, as you know, by the pilots about the way the pilots from Reno Air are not being integrated into the pay schedule of the American airline pilots. I think myself that issue is probably only the tip of the iceberg. When you get an issue like this suddenly erupting into that degree of response by the pilots, I mean, that much anger being manifested, then it's a pretty good idea that there are a whole bunch of issues simmering between American Airlines and its pilots.
Mm-hmm. But can you explain, though, on the issue of Reno Air, what the two-tiered system is like, why this is such a threat to American Airlines pilots to have another group of pilots, the Reno Air pilots, which were just bought by American, Reno Air, coming in at a lower pay level?
Well, it carries the possibility that American will want to use these lower-paid pilots in place of its regular pilots, And that's the fear. And also, from a union's point of view, when you have a two-tier system, it creates a division within the union. I'm not sure the extent to which this has been a factor, but it's very troublesome. Unions have learned that when they accept two levels of wages, it really is very destructive of the solidarity of the union. So there's the possibility of undercutting the pilots, and there's also the destruction of union solidarity.
We're also joined by Wesley Kennedy, who is a Chicago attorney who's represented union and employees in the airline industry. Where does American Airlines fit in terms of its labor relations with its pilots, flight attendants, et cetera?
Well, Jack Getman is correct, I think. Julius Getman is correct, I think, that the issue of Reno Air is just the tip of the iceberg. 15 years ago, American Airlines had a very pro-management pilot group. You could even almost have called the APA a company union 15 years ago. The pilots were so closely allied with management at that time. Over the last 15 years, however, there's been a long series of confrontations between the company and not just its pilots, but all of its employee groups, starting with the B scale. American Airlines invented the concept of the two-tier wage system, and over time, the number of pilots who had experienced that kind of treatment by their management has increased and in effect, took over political leadership of the union. So what you're seeing to a large extent here, I think, at least from my perspective on the outside of the specific situation, is really, to a large extent, American Airlines reaping the whirlwind of the culture that it's created in its atmosphere with its employees over the last decade or so.
Go ahead, Brett.
If I might also add to Professor Getman's discussion of the two-tier system, the specific grievance that the pilots have here is over a violation of what's called the scope clause in their contract, which is a provision which says generally all flying for American Airlines is going to be done by members of this union off of this seniority list under this contract. And there's one of these clauses in every pilot contract, and it's typical of labor contracts generally, defining what work belongs to the unions and the employees. The unions pay dearly for these provisions in negotiations, and they're very important to the union's protection of the job security of its members against the employer buying a low-cost operation and running a double-breasted operation where they have a union operation and then a lower-cost operation that they can whipsaw back and forth with the employees. So that's a very important strategic issue from the union's perspective, which is really fundamental to the union's ability to protect its members, and that's also a lot of what's going on here beyond just the raw numbers of the Reno pilots making more or the American pilots wanting some of the Reno pilots' jobs. There's some very important long-term strategic issues which are typical not just of American Airlines but of the industry generally.
We're talking to Wesley Kennedy, who is an attorney in Chicago who's represented union and employees in the airline industry. Professor Julius Getman is with us also, professor of labor law at the University of Texas, now at Georgetown University. And we're also joined by Rod Thurton, who is head of the Pan-Caribbean Research Institute and former professor of political science at the City University of New York. He'd also been director at the British West Indian Airways, which was formerly owned by the Trinidadian government and was privatized in 1995, and we're going down to Trinidad to speak to him today. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Rod Thurton.
Thank you.
Now, some listeners might be wondering, why are we going down to Trinidad to talk to you about a labor strike that is in court in Texas? But can you talk about your perspective on American Airlines?
Well, there are two reasons why it is important for me to be part of this discussion. One is the fact of American Airlines' presence in the Caribbean as really.
You're listening to Pacifica Radio. Just a little trouble there with our phone lines. We're going to get our guests back on in just a second. Again, our guests talking about American Airlines. It's the second largest airline in the United States, and there's been a massive pilot sick out over the last 10 days. Today, it looks like all but something like 36 flights have 36 flights have been canceled. But we're talking now to Rod Thurton, head of the Pan-Caribbean Research Institute. Rod?
Yeah, as I started to say, one is the presence of American Airlines here, the significant international carrier in the region. And this sick out has caused tremendous dislocation for the traveling public in the Caribbean, because particularly this weekend is what you, in Trinidad, it's Carnival weekend. And literally thousands of people from the United States come to Trinidad for the Carnival. So what you have had in areas like Miami and in New York are large numbers of people who have been at the airport for the past week and who are unable to come to Trinidad. And you also have a large number of people who have been leaving here, or at least want to leave here, and have not been able to do so. Some of them have had to take flights via Puerto Rico and have been stuck in Puerto Rico. So that from this point of view, you have the impact of the strike on the whole question of the traveling public in Trinidad and the region. But there's another, I might think, even more significant reason for this discussion, for us to be part of this discussion, in that BWIA, of which I am a director, has recently begun some discussions about the restructuring of the company. And one of the programs that have been proposed is to set up a West Indian Express service, which in many ways will be synonymous to Reno and American Airlines, in that the pilots in West Indian Express service would come be employed by BWI as a holding company under conditions that are very dissimilar from the pilots who are now employed by BWIA. And it has caused some very serious problems with the unions, who have been totally against the proposed restructuring of the company and the creation of this new subsidiary, West Indian Express. Not only the pilots, but all the four unions representing the workers of BWIA have been totally against it and have indicated their uncompromising rejection of the proposal for the very same reason that the workers, the pilots in American Airlines are responding to the situation in Reno. So there's a tremendous importance of the almost international implications of workers and this whole problem of employers of capital seeking to, so quote-unquote, cut costs in order to enhance profits and so on at the expense of and threatening the tremendous gains that workers have fought for decades upon decades to achieve.
That's Rod Thurton, head of the Pan-Caribbean Research Institute. He's speaking to us from Trinidad. Wesley Kennedy, does any of this ring a bell? Is it interesting to hear about American Airlines in the Caribbean?
Well, what the last speaker described is typical of what airlines are doing in the industry today. You're not seeing very many full-blown operational acquisitions and mergers today for a variety of reasons, including the labor problems that were caused by the integration of systems like Northwest and Republic and TWA and Ozark in the 1980s. What you're seeing today are alliances between airlines, such as Northwest and Continental. What you're seeing is alliances between commonly owned major airlines and regional carriers, such as what was just described in the Caribbean. Most of the major American carriers have regional affiliates, and one of the ongoing structural problems between the airlines and the employee groups in the industry is how you permit the employer to get the competitive advantages of having an operation like that without threatening the integrity of the union's jurisdiction over its work and the union's ability to protect its members' job security and standards of living against having these double-breasted systems. So this is an issue that's very common in the industry today, and it's probably going to become more common. As it becomes more common, you are probably more likely to see the increasing use of the kind of tactics that you've seen in fairly naked form at American in the last couple of weeks, which can loosely be called what we call in the business working to rule, which is the union communicates to its employees that we want you to strictly follow every safety procedure. We want you to strictly follow everything you're required to do under the contract, and we don't want you to volunteer to do anything. This is not the first time this kind of tactic has been used. It's been used at other airlines as employees and unions attempted to protect their interests. So you're likely to see it happen more commonly, I think.
One problem, though, that we in the Caribbean are facing now, particularly where you have had this transition from state ownership to private enterprise, the privatization, so-called privatization, is an experience that we saw earlier, a few years ago, with United, where you have union members on the board of directors of these companies and participating in the discussions and decisions about this quote-unquote restructuring, and on the other hand, having to represent the interests of the workers. And that is a dilemma that I see expressing itself with the two union representatives on the board of BWIA today, where they have had some very serious problems to deal with this dilemma of, on the one hand, being members of the board of directors, and on the other hand, having to protect the interests of the workers and the conditions laid down in the contracts.
On that note, Rod Thurton, we're going to have to wrap up the discussion, but I want to thank you very much for being with us, head of the Pan-Caribbean Research Institute in Trinidad, Wesley Kennedy from Chicago, an attorney who has represented employees in the airline industry, and Julius Gettman, professor of labor law at the University of Texas, now visiting professor at Georgetown University. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. Are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Again, the latest news that we have in Turkey and around Europe is the arrest of the Kurdish rebel leader Abdullah Öcalan. In just a few minutes, we're going to be speaking about his significance. He was taken from the Greek embassy in Kenya and has been deported to Turkey, where he will be tried. He could face the death penalty. There have been protests all over Europe. Dozens of people have actually immolated themselves, set themselves on fire. Many embassies, particularly Greek embassies, have been taken over in protest by Kurds. And we're going to talk about that in the last segment of the show. But right now, we're going to talk about a report by the Justice Department. A study released over the weekend by the Justice Department says that American Indians are the victims of violent crime at a rate of more than twice the national average. The study also found that Native Americans, unlike other groups, are most likely to be the victims of violent crimes committed by members of a race other than their own, particularly white people. In fact, over 60% of violent crimes against American Indians are committed by whites, while 29% of the offenders were other Indians, 10% African American. By contrast, other studies have shown that 70% of those committing violent crimes against whites are also white, and that 81% of those committing violent crimes against blacks are also black. We're joined right now by Mike Hermeni-Horses, who is a councilman and tribal historian in Rapid City, South Dakota. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Good morning.
Thank you for joining us. Why don't you start off by sharing your response to this Justice Department report, particularly looking at the level of violent crime against Native Americans?
Well, if we look at it in a historical context, for instance, Pine Ridge Reservation was established in 1878. This, you know, that time period was the last, I guess what you would call a treaty-making era, when the government tried to treat for land with Indians when they couldn't get the our people to go along with the proposals the government was making. They took the land instead, just acquired it through legislation. So I look at it as the late 1870s as kind of a benchmark in terms of our relationship, and it really soured after that. There were several subsequent federal acts, the 1889 Act, which created the Homestead Act. Anyway, our people have a sense that the government has never, ever played fair with us, and when they interact with us, they steal land. They take land. So there's been a long period of this kind of mistrust, and it's kind of spilled over into our neighbors, you know, the non-Indians living around our reservation. So there's an ongoing friction, and that whenever there's social gatherings, basketball tournaments, any kind of interaction that we have from leaving the reservation to go outside and interact with whites, there's a potential for violence. In the past, it's manifested itself so many times that it's kind of accepted when you leave and travel to Rapid City or to one of the border towns in Nebraska. You have to be extra vigilant about your behavior because the police are watching you. You have to be extra vigilant with merchants because they think you're going to rob you. You're going to rob them. So it's just kind of mistrust, and then that when you put drugs and alcohol in the mix, it's not a very good situation out here.
Mike, from Many Horses, we're also joined by Peter Iverson, professor of American Indian History at Arizona State University. He also teaches at Diné College, formerly known as the Navajo Community College, and he's written a book called We Are Still Here, American Indians in the 20th Century. Can you talk, Professor Iverson, about the effects of migration on Native Americans from reservation to the city and how that relates to the violence against Native Americans?
Yes, I'd be glad to. And let me just correct briefly. I'm a former instructor at Navajo Community College. But one of the factors we do look at here is the matter of urbanization and the fact that a significant percentage of Native Americans today live in urban areas, both within reservations and also in off-reservation border towns and in cities. And the most likely victim of violence, according to this Bureau of Justice Statistics report, is an American Indian male from 18 to 24 living in a household with an income less than $10,000 in an urban setting. So certainly there is an ongoing trend toward urbanization, and with urbanization there is a higher percentage of crime with that trend.
We're also joined by Suzanne Harjo, who is president of the Morning Star Institute, an Indian rights advocacy group, who speaks to us from Washington, D.C. Overall, Suzanne Harjo, if you could respond to this Justice Department report as we get comments from Mike or Many Horses in South Dakota and Peter Iverson in Arizona.
Well, good morning, all. I am not surprised by the study. I do think that it's part of the overall hatred and dehumanization of Native peoples that has obviously not decreased in these many centuries since we ran into these folks on our shores. And I am not surprised that it comes primarily from white people, because they're the ones who objectify us and dehumanize us most. We're used for their recreation. were used to sell their products and were targeted for mascotting and for name-calling in a way that is unacceptable for any other segment of society today. So when you have a population that is dehumanized, especially coupled with a past of conflict, you're going to have this result, and it shouldn't be a surprise.
What do you think can be done? And also, this brings in the whole issue of the reservation system in this country and the level of integration of Native Americans. Mike from Many Horses, what are your thoughts?
Well, unlike a lot of other groups, you know, I feel my own opinion is that our people, you know, they can choose to join the American mainstream, but for the most part, I think we would like to be left with what little resources we have to attempt some development. The, you know, a lot of the things that we see out there, we're not particularly, you know, wanting to jump into. Overall, I think we need to settle some historic issues. One is land theft, and it continues today. The Senate, under the when they passed the omnibus spending bill, included a little section that snatched 200,000 acres of the Sioux Nation's land along the Missouri River, and there's no great outcry against that. So it's like we're relegated to just footnotes all the time, you know. All them poor Indians, something's happening to them again. Well, we're growing, and we're going to continue to grow, and we're going to be here. And so to the point that the federal government can be honorable and act with us in a very judicious and honorable way, I don't see, you know, a whole lot changing. We're on the bottom, you know, and the only way back is up. That's the start for me.
I just got this week's edition of Roll Call, which is a newspaper of Capitol Hill, and in it there is a special edition on civil rights. And among the people that write articles are the Democrat who became Republican, Senator Ben Nighthorse Campbell of Colorado. And the piece is headlined, Joint Panel Needed to Settle Issues. And Campbell writes, the Indian Affairs Committee in the 105th Congress considered the most profound changes in federal Indian policy since the termination era of the 1950s. At issue was a bill that would have eliminated tribal governments' sovereign immunity from lawsuit. Proponents said this was necessary so people could challenge tribal actions that affect them. The opponents say it would bankrupt the tribes, leaving them unable to govern themselves. Peter Iverson, professor of American Indian History at Arizona State University, what are your thoughts on this?
Well, I think I agree with my distinguished colleagues that there is certainly an ongoing pattern of violence against Native peoples in this country, and these statistics are not shocking, but they are revealing. And I would encourage listeners to use the Bureau of Justice Statistics Worldwide web homepage, www.ojp.usdoj.gov/bjs/, to get this full report, which is what I did yesterday. And part of what we need to fight against and work for, we need to fight against ignorance, and we need to fight for knowledge. And these statistics really are damning. The fact that that young Indian men and women between the ages of 18 and 24 have the highest per capita rate of violence against them of any group in our country, and it's approximately one out of every four people in this particular demographic category. So that is really important for us to understand and to work toward doing something about it.
Could you repeat that website?
Yes, it's www.ojp.usdoj.gov/bjs/. And it's about a 50-page report, so it has a lot of important data. And we all know that people say there are lies, damned lies, and statistics, and we have every right to be somewhat wary of any statistical presentation. But this is certainly well worth our attention.
And that website is where the Justice Department report on crimes against Native Americans is. And again, the conclusion of that report is that American Indians are the victims of violent crime at a rate of more than twice the national average, while in all other ethnic groups in this country, people of their own ethnic group are the ones who perpetrate the crimes against them, and not just ethnic groups, but races, etc., like whites against whites. In the case of Native Americans, whites commit most of the crimes against Native Americans. But also in this piece by Senator Ben Nighthorse Campbell, there is a photograph of Native Americans, and it says new welfare reform laws may force these residents in Minnesota reservation to leave to find work. And Suzanne Harjo, I'm wondering, what is the effect of the welfare reform laws on Native Americans and displacing them?
Well, it really transfers for the smaller Indian nations, smaller in population, all the controls to the state, who, as one of the Supreme Court justices in the past has called the tribe's deadliest enemies. And so the states exercise a certain control, but it comes with strings, or they don't give the money or give money inadequately. So it has caused a lot of displacement and impoverished a lot of already very poor Indians, especially those who live off reservation. And earlier you had said that this report calls into question the entire reservation system. That I have to disagree with that and agree with what Mike Hermanyhorses says. The reservation system, if you will, I mean, those are our homes. We have no old country to go to. Those are our homes, and those are the places of sanctuary for us. What is endangered are our people once off the reservations and our sacred lands that are in control of the government or that are in control of private forces. And so we have to change the laws that keep us from some of our most sacred places, and we don't own what we should, and we don't control what we own, much of it, and we have to change the laws that affect that. We have to end the genocidal policies, and that is part of what sanctions and allows these individual murders and violences to occur against us.
I'm going to give Mike Hermanyhorses the last word, councilman and tribal historian in Rapid City, South Dakota, of where we go from here, where Native Americans go from here in terms of their own safety.
Well, actually, I'm not from Rapid City. I live about 100 miles, but I live in Wounded Knee, South Dakota. I think where we go is that there's been some efforts in South Dakota. We, for a term, had what we call the Year of Reconciliation. The governor then was Mickelson, and tried to, you know, talk about the issues of racism in this state. But now we got a governor named Bill Jankla who feels he's a reincarnated Indian fighter, and that's at the state government level. And is there any reconciliation efforts that went on or gone? And so we have to fight state government that we support with our own taxes. You know, the governor publicly says that he's not going to encourage tourists to come to our reservation, you know, so we face all of that. So where we go as tribal leaders, I think, is we need to make sure that we be very careful not to have incendiary language when we speak, and you know, do what we can to protect our young people, because our median age here at Pine Ridge is 19, and those are the ones that are affected, as you stated in that report. And we can't have a damaged, extremely damaged group going into the next millennia, because we want to prosper just as anyone does. We want to live and be at the table. And so where we go is we got to really sit back and use our spiritual and cultural ways to chart us a new path.
Well, on that note, I want to thank you all for joining us. Mike Hermeni Horses from Wounded Knee, South Dakota, councilman and tribal historian. Suzanne Harjo, president of the Morning Star Institute and Indian Rights Advocacy Group. And Peter Iverson, professor of American Indian History at Arizona State University, author of the book We Are Still Here, American Indians in the 20th Century. Thank you for being with us. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back talking about the Kurdish rebel leader Öcalan in just a minute. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Kurdish rebel leader Abdullah Öcalan's international quest for asylum ended today after Turkey's prime minister announced that Öcalan had been brought to Turkey to face justice. Prime Minister Ecevit said, "We had promised that the state would catch him. We have kept our promise." He went on to say he will pay the price of his accounts to the independent Turkish courts. Öcalan's capture is a victory for Turkey, which wants to prosecute him for waging a 14-year guerrilla war for autonomy. He faces the death penalty if convicted. Ecevit did not say when Turkey would put Öcalan on trial. Öcalan was once tried in absentia, but verdict was never issued. Öcalan dropped from sight after leaving Rome in January. He was brought to Turkey today after surfacing in Kenya. Ecevit said his capture was the result of a 12-day covert operation, but gave no details. He did not say where Öcalan was being held. Öcalan's capture sparked Kurdish demonstrations across Europe, with protesters storming Greek diplomatic compounds. The Greek foreign minister said Öcalan went to Kenya on February 2nd and was given refuge in the Greek embassy in Nairobi. The Greek prime minister went on to say Öcalan left against the advice of his hosts, heading for the Nairobi airport yesterday to fly to the Netherlands. Greek authorities said they lost track of him after he left the Greek compound. But another account was offered by a Kenyan guard at the Greek ambassador's residence. The guard, who spoke on condition of anonymity, said men in Kenyan government vehicles entered the compound and forcibly removed three men last night. The guard said the men had been in the compound for about 2 weeks, but was unsure whether any of them was Öcalan. He said the men were forced into a vehicle, which sped off in a convoy that included the Greek ambassador. Today, Kenya asked Greece to recall its ambassador, accusing him of sneaking Öcalan into the country under a false name. The Kenyan foreign minister denied any Kenyan role in the rebel leader's seizure yesterday. In Rome, Öcalan's Italian lawyers, clearly stunned by his capture, said they did not believe the rebel leader would have left the compound on his own. His attorney said he visited Öcalan in Nairobi on Sunday, and he said, "Öcalan told me his life was in grave danger." The lawyer went on to say he feared for his client's safety in Turkish hands. We're joined right now by two people. Connie Shulam is with us, director of the American Kurdish Information Network, joining us in our Washington studio at WPFW. And Ertuğrul Kerku joins us from Turkey. He is a journalist for IPS, a third world news service. Why don't we begin with Mr. Kerku? What is happening right now in Istanbul as a result of the capture of Öcalan?
Actually, in Istanbul, there's not much movement, but there are a lot of police controls on certain points in anticipation of protests, demonstrations around. But since morning, there has not been reported any important action on the part of Kurdish people living in Istanbul or Kurdish militants. Now it seems quiet. That's all we can know about for the time being. But in Ankara, in the capital, the prime minister has victoriously announced that the Turkish government has captured Öcalan, and this great success on their part, he says. And as long as we look at the Kurdish satellite TV, MET TV, broadcasting from Brussels, there is a great reaction among the Kurds in exile in Europe, or the Gastarbeiter Kurds in Europe, and many Kurdish embassies, many Greek embassies have been occupied by Kurdish demonstrators. And in the MET TV, it's reported, it's broadcasted that the armed branch of the PKK, the Liberation Army of Kurdistan, leaders say that Kurds in Turkey should do anything in their hand with all their militancy to safeguard the life of their leader. And they say they believe that Öcalan's life is under grave danger. But the government assures that no harm, no kind of violation of human rights have been occurred during his capture or later detention. But still, Öcalan is now kept out of the eyes of the media for the time being, and it's still uncertain when he is going to be displayed to the media. That's for the time being.
We're talking to Ertuğrul Kerku, who is speaking to us from Istanbul, Turkey, on a remarkably good phone line. Connie Shulam joining us from Washington, D.C., with the American Kurdish Information Network. Again, we have reports from The Hague, London, Brussels, Vienna, Marseille, Moscow, Bonn, Frankfurt, Geneva, Bern, Zurich, Copenhagen, and other cities of major protests as Kurds rally in support of the Kurdish guerrilla leader Abdullah Öcalan after his arrest in Kenya and handover to Turkey. Connie Shulam, can you tell us who Öcalan is? Why is he so significant to the Kurds around the world?
He's the only Kurd that has succeeded in Turkey to fight the Turkish government and succeed in bringing this issue to the table. Until 1988, if my memory serves me right, the Turkish newspapers wouldn't even talk about the word Kurd. Turkish constitution doesn't even make a reference to the word Kurd or Kurds. And he forced the government to grapple with this issue. He brought this issue to the table. And the Kurds all across the world felt, and most of them live in Turkey, about 52% of them, felt that because he succeeded in doing that, he earned their support and their admiration or affection. And today's news is has stunned them. And so he's a Kurdish rebel. He's fighting for the rights of the Kurds.
What are the issues of the Kurds, not only in Turkey, of course, but maybe you can explain what the Kurdistan that Öcalan envisions actually encompasses?
We're talking about the rights of the subject people to self-determination in the Middle East. We have people like Turks in the Middle East. We have people like Israelis, Arabs, Persians, and Kurds. And many of those other peoples have their countries, but the Kurds don't. And the Kurds are abused, are systematically persecuted. In Turkey, they used to be called Mountain Turks. In Iraq, Saddam Hussein keeps gassing them with chemical weapons. In Iran, Shah abused them. Khomeini followed suit. We are tired of being ruled. We are tired of being abused. We are tired of being denied our humanity, our identity. And the fight has been ugly, has been bloody, has been costly. The government of Turkey could have settled this problem when Öcalan renounced violence, when he time and again went on the air on MET TV, declared three ceasefires Last time when he went in, when he was in Italy, he bent backward to extend an olive branch, but the powers that be in Ankara, in Washington, in London, in Paris, unfortunately declined his offer. My hunch is this arrest will unleash a wave of violence and make it much worse than it is. We're today talking about peace talks for Serbians and Albanians in Paris, in France, under the aegis of the major powers, NATO powers. The same could have happened for the Kurds and the Turks. That bloodletting could have stopped. But unfortunately, no leader of vision appeared on this issue. And the beneficiaries are the arms merchants, and the sufferers are the Kurds and the Turks and Turkish soldiers, of course.
We've heard a lot about the suffering of Kurds in Iraq because Iraqi government, Saddam Hussein, is the official enemy of the United States. And so what happens to the Kurds, we hear something about in northern Iraq. But in Turkey, where you have a government that is an ally of the United States, you don't hear as much about the Kurds. What specifically happens to the Kurds in Turkey? How many are there? And what is the Turkish government policy towards them?
You know, nobody knows exactly how many Kurds live in Turkey because we were never allowed to count ourselves. And nobody trusted us enough to have us do that. But if you look at the family sizes, if you look at the rural settings that most of the Kurds live in, we're talking about a population of 15 to 20 million, some even put it higher, people who live in a country on their land, just like in your earlier program, like the Native Americans lived on their land for millennia. And the Turks came about 1,000 years ago, and they had their empire, and now they have their republic. But in the course of the republic, they adopted nationalistic, what in this country we might call racist policies of banning Kurdish language, denying Kurds their culture. And we're talking about, 52% of the Kurdish territory and 50 to 55% of the Kurds living in that part of the country, in that part of the land that's now under Turkish rule. And the result has been rebellions after rebellions. The result has been bloodletting after bloodletting. The government of Turkey refuses to acknowledge the existence of the Kurds. Only wants the Kurds that bent, they accept the denial of their identity, reluctantly gives in to their rights, now has allowed the music tapes to be sold, but only reluctantly after so much blood. It's a dead knot that has to be resolved. And the government of Turkey is incapable of resolving it. It needs help from Europe. It needs help from the U.S.
The way the media puts it, they talk about Öcalan waging a 14-year guerrilla war for autonomy that's claimed tens of thousands of lives. They say he was particularly brutal in going after rival groups. What is your response to that?
The path to independence is not a straight path. When you look at the history of other independence movements, there are mistakes. There have been mistakes. And Öcalan has himself said that mistakes have been made. And he actually flew to Rome, to Netherlands, to appear before The Hague International Court to account for his sins, if you will. But nobody took him seriously. Everybody thought, he shouldn't come because U.S. didn't want it. Europeans wanted their trade with Turkey and their arms sales to Turkey. So Öcalan himself has said that mistakes have been made, and he himself has said that he's willing to pay the price. But the we're talking about a larger genocidal policy that the government of Turkey implements, killing civilians, forcing them to forget their language. This is a crime of humanity, against humanity, and nobody talks about that. There's a cultural violence in the region. I'll be the first to admit that too. But adding arms to that cultural violence makes it worse. It doesn't make it less.
Ertuğrul Kerkü in Istanbul, Turkey. What is your response to Kani Shulam's depiction of what is happening in Turkey right now to the Kurds? And is it the same picture you have from Istanbul?
Generally, I can say that I also admit that the Kurds in Turkey are subjugated and oppressed, and their cultural and national identity is denied. This is an absolute truth. But I wouldn't say that this is a difference between us, but something that he didn't mention. Due to Kurdish resistance, dissidents, gathering momentum in the last decade, Kurds in Turkey have succeeded in somehow building their own civil society and gaining a semi-official, semi-legal status for their presence. There are now scores of Kurdish language newspapers in Turkey, pro-Kurdish dailies, political parties who have been defending the rights of the Kurds. Of course, they are under pressure. They are harassed. They are not granted the same degree of freedom or liberty that the official parties have, but they still survive a semi-legal status, and their presence and their policies have also affected most Turkish political groups, particularly on the left, to recognize the rights of the Kurds, to put it in their platforms, their programs, and due to this arduous fight for 15 years, there has been a change in the mentality of Turkish politicians, particularly on the left, and the understanding between the Kurdish and Turkish peoples, I mean the grassroots, the public. We cannot talk about a kind of a national or ethnic hatred against Kurds or on the part of Kurds against Turks. So,
Ertuğrul Kerku, let me ask something since we're wrapping up the program. You've covered your government, you know it well. Do you think they would give the Kurdish rebel leader Öcalan the death penalty?
You know, actually, looking at the problem from the existing, from the point of view of existing laws, existing procedures, they are going to at least indict him with high treason, and this is death penalty. But if they are going to, if this is going to continue like this, I'm not very sure about this. But now, personally, against Öcalan, the Turkish government and Turkish media has ignited a very broad hatred personally against him. So he's personally been
vilified,
taken responsible for all what happened. And this is not, of course, true. You know, if you are talking about a war, there are two sides to it, and Öcalan himself cannot have committed all what happened. So,
Ertuğrul Kerku, I want to thank you for being with us from Istanbul, Turkey. I'm only sorry the conversation's come to an end. Kani Shulam, very quickly, can you give the phone number of the American Kurdish Information Network in Washington, D.C.?
It's 202-483-6444, and we also have a website, www.kurdistan.org.
That's www.kurdistan.org and 202-483-6444. Thank you both for being with us. That does it for today's show. If you'd like to order a cassette, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. Democracy Now! Is produced by Maria Carrion. Errol Maitland is our technical director. Joe Gill, engineered from Washington. From the studios of WBAI in New York, I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!